Welcome, everybody, to the Business Analysis Summit 2010. I'm Penny Pullen of Making Projects Work Limited, and I'm your host for all of the calls in this BA Summit. If you'd like to see a list of all the speakers and their topics, then please visit www.basummit.com. Today, I'm delighted to be interviewing Ellen Gottesdiener, founder of ebgconsulting.com. Ellen, like me, is a certified professional facilitator, and from seeing her in action at her session at the recent BA 2010 Conference Europe, I know that she's a fabulous workshop facilitator, as well as being the author of leading books on requirements. She's written both Requirements by Collaboration and the Software Requirements Memory Jogger. Ellen and her team are experts in elicitation, analysis, and collaboration, helping organizations to bring good practice, working with them, training them, especially working with project and business teams to deliver the right product at the right time. Ellen's going to focus today on what agile means to the business analyst. It certainly seems to be a very strong theme in the industry at the moment. I'm looking forward to hearing your views, Ellen. I'm sure all of you who are listening are too. We've had so many questions coming in about agile and agility. So without much more ado, Ellen Gottesdiener, I'm delighted to welcome you to the BA Summit 2010.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Penny, and thank you for what you're doing for our community by hosting this BA Summit.
Fantastic. Without people like you, Ellen, it wouldn't be happening. So again, thank you for joining. I suppose I've got a question I'd like to put in before I put to you the questions that have come in from people who have registered. The first question that I'd like to ask is, what do you mean by agile?
Well, this is a really good question, and some people talk about agile as big A or little A. If you actually look the term up in the thesaurus, you'll find that it means nimble or light or moving quickly. So it's about the ability to change and adapt more so than hurrying up. I think there's a misconception or misunderstanding. The thing is that you're not agile because you're going faster or doing things faster. You're faster because you're agile. So agile includes the ability and the learning and the knowledge about what not to do as much as what to do. So much of agile, I think, and the value that analysis work, business analysis work, lends to it is helping the business and technical team together figure out what the right thing to do is and knowing when to shift and change and, you know, knowing what to stop doing is as important as what to start doing. So that's really very valuable. For me personally, the collaboration aspects of Agile are so much part of the heart of Agile. You know, there's the head and the practices. But the heart of Agile is people collaborating, cross-functional teams collaborating, and that includes with the business. So, and when I wrote the first book, Requirements by Collaboration, it's all about collaboration workshops, facilitated workshops, and so it's quite a joy for me when the Agile movement caught on, although there is clearly some hype around it. But the real teams that really are being agile in addition to doing agile have this collaboration thing down pat.
Fantastic. And as trained facilitators, you know, that really is the heart of what we do anyway. So collaboration being at the heart of agile, it makes sense. And ability to change and adapt at the moment in the current environment for most industries, that's got to be pretty important, hasn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's absolutely true, Penny. So even if you're not formally, we'll talk about this, I'm sure, with the questions coming in, even if you're not formally doing Agile, there's a lot of things that we can do in our analysis work to be Agile and to help teams and business people think better about what the right things to do are.
We've got a question that I think follows on nicely from some of that, and it is, how do you measure business agility improvements?
Yeah, well, excuse me, that is a really interesting question, because business agility improvement sort of implies that business agility should be one of the goals of the business. I think we first want to make sure we know what the business mission really is, and see if the adaptability that you get with Agile is really what is important. So there's two aspects there. One is aligning what we do and making good choices to the business. One very simple model I really like is the purpose alignment model, a quadrant where you look at the aspects of mission critical and market differentiating along a gradient from low to high. And where the business has mission critical and market differentiating high in both quadrants, those are the things that we want to really focus our competencies on. So doing, then that's part of doing the right thing. The other thing is that's really critical is understanding our stakeholders and customers. Clarifying who do we serve, and are we doing the right thing for them. So when it comes to the measures, you know, measures are useful, but we first need to say, well the context counts. So let's say, you know, if the question is agility improvement, maybe that's really not what the real need is. For example, if you're in a hospital emergency room, do we want to measure how many patients we can get in and out? Or maybe it's more important that the medical outcome is what we want to measure. Right?
Yes, Ellen, certainly having been in one in the last couple of weeks when I sprained my ankle very badly, I would say speed in and out, far less important than getting it sorted properly.
Yes, exactly. You know, the triage, and that triage model actually is very apropos in our requirements work, in our product development work, because not all requirements are created equal, and making smart choices about what do you do first, do the top 20% most important things first and learn, and this is part of what Agile is, because you pause to learn and get feedback, and then you figure out what the next chunk is. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's some very, very powerful financial models, return on investment models, that show that this kind of incremental delivery, so you're basically funding the future development with current development with the most important features, is really smart. So the context, going back to this idea of context, and we talked about the ER room, I recently worked with a medical device company that's using Agile practices. And, you know, do we want to measure how quickly they can build the devices, or is it more important that they have no failure rate when they put something in your body? Yet, on the other hand, when we look at an organization that's doing media marketing, you know, the cost of delay can be an important measure, or the cost, the ability to replenish goods quickly. Well, that's kind of sort of an Agile metric. That might be useful. So, you know, we could go on with this, but I think the point is that we need to understand what the business purpose is, who the customers we're solving, then figure out what are the measures, benchmark or understand our current measures, benchmark them against competition and possible future, and then figure out what the right thing to measure is.
The answer to that question is probably it depends, doesn't it? One of my favorite
standard consultant answer that I'm sure we've all are all familiar with. You know, but there still are, of course, classic measures, an Agile measure like Lean. In Lean is cycle time and throughput.
Yep.
And I think that's something that is apropos for business analysis work, because in traditional practices, or let's put it this way, how traditional software requirements engineering practices have been interpreted, there's all of these handoffs, and that stalls throughput and delays cycle time, creates lots of handovers, result in delays and defects. So, you know, some of the practices from Lean and that where teams, cross-functional teams, can pause and look at what is mm-hmm. our value stream, so to speak, in terms of delivering yeah. a business solution, can be useful to identifying how we can collaborate better and look at how can we get from, as the Papandikes say in their books, from concept to cash, so to speak, quicker.
Yeah,
and software is only part of the solution. It's not, not the panacea.
Again, that's coming out over and over again as we do these sessions, that software is just part of the solution. Right.
Yes. I think another measure, it's a measure that I always wish we had, and I've seen this in so many businesses. Why can't we measure how quickly we can truncate or kill unproductive projects or non-value-added projects? Wouldn't that be a great measure? That would drive different behavior. It would drive the behavior of learning as quickly as we can if we're going to get the value that we need. Yeah. That would be a neat measure.
The other thing is that a business analyst could probably is more likely to see that something is a non-value add, because project managers, speaking as a project manager some of the time, once you see that delivery date, it can be quite hard to say, actually, is it worth doing what I'm doing?
Mm-hmm.
So the business analyst maybe could be a good person to help increase that truncate or kill non-value add projects. Mm.
Yes, and collaborating. There's a blending of roles often with analysis and classic project management, particularly in agile projects. But, if you look at classic measures of value are usually related to money. I like to use an acronym that helps me remember and working with teams, that I like to use IRACIS or ERASCUS.
Oh, yeah.
And I will translate that and then add two things. So ERASCUS stands for increase revenue, which basically means make more money.
Okay.
AC is avoid costs, that is save operational costs, streamline the business. And IS is improve service. So happier customers return and they recommend you. So ERASCUS, increase revenue, avoid costs, improve service. Those are often monetary based measures. But there's also meeting regulatory requirements.
Yeah.
And I've worked with many regulated, as I know you do too, industries. And if you violate a regulation you can get fined, you can have people go to jail, you can be on the on CNN worldwide and get bad press. So adhering to regulatory requirements is also a value. Then the third area would be market value. There may be things you need to do to be on par with the marketplace or for brand recognition and so forth. So those are sort of some broad categories in terms of metrics that analysts can help teams and business management look at to figure out really what is it that we want to measure, what's the business value of the work that we're trying to do, which may or may not involve software, and try to get some feedback on those measures as soon as possible.
Mm. That's really good. Thank you. We've got an interesting question that's come in, and I know that you work quite visually when you can be together with people. So I wonder what you think of this one. What role does or should mind mapping play in agile requirements elicitation?
Okay, well, first let me quickly define mind mapping for those that may not be familiar with it. Mind mapping comes from Tony Buzan, and it's actually a very simple visual technique, thinking tool. You basically draw a circle in the center with some topic or idea, and then from there you draw spokes out, maybe with words with circles around them, almost like some of you may have seen an orbit diagram. But you include pictures as much as possible. So mind mapping as a thinking tool for me is an expand activity. In Requirements by Collaboration, I wrote about collaboration patterns. One of them is called expand and contract. So the group of participants need to expand and get all the ideas and thoughts and different diverse points of view out. Then use some filter, some sieve, to then contract to select one or more things depending on the situation. Mind mapping is in that expand area. So mind mapping would be one of the things that I've used mind mapping for in workshops is where I'll put small groups together in a team around a poster with different colored markers and ask them to, for example, a focus question might be, summarize some of your key learning points from that last activity that we just did. Maybe we did a visioning activity, or maybe we looked at the highest priority items in the backlog, or had somebody come in and present some business information, whatever it is. And it gets, particularly when you ask people to do it silently, it gets them thinking on a different, with a different mode, more right-brained thinking as opposed to left-brain, more the right brain handling our visual, spatial, musical, auditory, the, quote, creative brain as opposed to the left linear, more precise brain that we have. So because it's free form and the connections can be loose, it can be really helpful. And it wouldn't be something just segregated to agile. I'll tell you personally, it's not, I use mind mapping personally as a thinking tool to come up with outlines, to think about what do I want to say in this blog post or this article. And then from there, organize it. I use it in workshops to help teams prepare for a show and tell after a long workshop or series of workshops. So it's not when we say elicitation, which is acquiring the requirements from our stakeholders, it's actually not one of the classic elicitation techniques like prototypes, interviews, facilitated workshops, focus groups, observation, right? It's not one of those, but it can be used in the context of, say, a workshop or preparing for a workshop. Does that make sense?
Perfect. In fact, I've just used mind maps to do my book, which is coming out next year, on facilitating risk. And quite a lot of the business analysts in the UK had some input into that. So fantastic. And you've also answered another question from the summit, which I didn't give you, which was somebody asked, should an analyst be right or left-brained? And, of course, you need to bring both and your personality into your analysis work is what's coming out very strongly.
Right. So the answer to that question is yes.
Exactly. So thank you for answering an extra question. That's great. The next question I've got is interesting. It's from somebody in a particular field, but I suspect that the sort of generalization of the question would be quite interesting to many. The questioner asks, much talk is made of the wonders of the agile methodology, and it's often touted as a panacea to the evils of the waterfall. In businesses such as mobile telecoms, so I suspect that's where that person comes from, it is difficult to see Agile working for much of what we do, save for the odd customer-facing web interface. Am I deluded?
Well, first, I hope the person truly doesn't think that they're deluded, but it's good to think about the usage of techniques in context. You know, in general, right, there's an expression of best practices. Personally, I don't like that expression because best practices are really just good practices in a context. So context counts for everything that we do at a personal level, broader level, context really counts. So you and I, I'll speak for myself here, Penny, I have been around the block enough to know that there is no panacea, there is no silver bullet, no wonder pill. Agile isn't one of those. The evils of waterfall, the question asked talked about the evils of waterfall. It's really interesting because when we think about waterfall, just a little bit of history here, Winston Royce wrote a paper that was published in IEEE in 1970, and he was writing about the development of large systems. And he starts by describing this grandiose process, which became known as waterfall, that he then went on to totally disclaim throughout the article. So in other words, he posited, here's waterfall, and here's all the reasons why you shouldn't use it. But what happened was people picked it up And it became the de facto standard for the way things should be done.
I've read that paper too, and it's quite fun, isn't it? Everybody refers to Audible, see this paper, and then you look at the real paper, and it looks much more, you know, some of it, almost agile, really, in the iteration.
Exactly. Got it, Penny, because he's pointing back through all these phases, if you will, and saying that it's nuts to try to do things in a waterfall. So the problem, what we have, some sensible things, and by the way, agile practices, this isn't new. Many of these practices have been around since the 60s. And there's history and background and usage of many of the practices. We've gotten repackaged through the Agile Manifesto and quite a bit of hype around them, but some of these good practices with Agile have been around for some time. But one of the things that makes sense about Agile, which Royce's paper does talk about, not as directly, but there's something called wicked problems. Yeah. And a wicked problem is one where the problem space and the solution space overlap. In other words, you don't really know what the right solution is until you start to build it.
Yep.
So Agile practices of early feedback and taking small pieces, you know, chopping down complexity, building a small piece and getting feedback and learning, which is actually one of the key things that happens in innovation, is really quite sensible. There's also, I don't know if anyone listening has studied chaos theory, but if you think about evolution, evolution is actually chaos with feedback. So this idea of feedback and learning and adaptability, which is really what Agile really is about, not the hype about this or that, really is quite sensible. Now, the question is about mobile telecoms, and as it turns out, one of the biggest mobile telecoms, Nokia, was one of the early adapters of Agile, Scrum specifically, for software engineering, and they're probably the one of the organizations on the planet that's been using Agile the longest and has done a transformation from the late 90s into Agile. So Agile practices are not just for user interface. I think the question was about the customer-facing web interface. Not everything that's built in Nokia or in a mobile device, a company doing mobile telecom, is strictly customer-facing UI things on the device. I personally have worked with clients that are building hardware and software for mailing and communication, medical devices, embedded medical training software. So there's not a relegation just to applications that use user interface.
Interesting. I was in a big bank yesterday, and some of the people were doing things traditionally, and some people are using Agile for some quite heavyweight developments.
Yeah, I mean, the practices like having a prioritized backlog, continuous integration, small iteration, limiting work in progress, which is really very powerful part of Lean and Kanban, collaboration with cross-functional teams, inspect and adapt, progressive elaboration. This stuff, that those practices work very effectively on many types of products.
Super. The next question is one that actually I think I asked you when we met earlier this year at the BA conference in Europe. How can agile development work on a distributed delivery? I think maybe I asked you when the teams were separated, when they were distributed.
Yeah. Well, the honest answer to that is with difficulty. Whether you're doing agile practices or any other practices, using distributed team is very difficult because you have to build in additional infrastructure for the handovers. It requires, in agile practices, which relies so much on a cross-functional collaboration, it requires teams to build in more infrastructure and use technology to communicate, not drop the fact that we need to communicate on a daily basis. Mm. Some people actually like some of the aspects of distributed teams because you can have a team building things while another team is sleeping.
Yep.
And test and do feedback on
yeah.
that. One of the things that should be considered is how you organize the teams,
mm.
particularly with Agile. Mm. Ideally, if you're going to have distributed teams, what you want to have is a product owner or customer, that is the business expert who's making the decisions about what to build and when,
yeah.
that is located with the team, physically located with the team.
Yeah.
I've worked with teams where we couldn't do that, and so we had agreement on a strategy where that product owner was available during certain
yeah.
hours every day for mm. the distributed team. Now, so the product owner, the co-location of the product owner would be the first thing. The
yeah.
other thing is to try to use, let's say, feature teams. And we
mm.
think about requirements, and we think about the entire backlog, which we'll go back to the issue of visioning and chartering, which is something you ideally do together. But if you look at the backlog and do some high-level road mapping, what you do is you look at the requirements to understand what the features or functionality is. And when I say features, I'm meaning the both functional and non-functional requirements using requirements engineering terminology.
Of course. Yeah.
And you want to partition those features so that a team is working on a highly cohesive but loosely coupled set of requirements.
Mm.
So this reduces the coupling work across distributed teams that has to be done and significantly reduces the risk in terms of all the software problems and architecture problems that can happen.
Mm.
So that requires some smart planning up front to do that, highly cohesive, loosely coupled feature teams, if you will, and figuring out how they're going to synchronize and have really, really good testing practices and be very unambiguous in developing tests, so they have to be excellent in that area. One team I work with, they wanted to outsource testing to another country, and we got the team together, we did some training, and we did some road mapping and building up the backlog. And what the team decided with the management there was, maybe not so much. Let's do this. Let's pull in from, and this happened to me, the test team was in India. Let's pull in the lead from India and have him work with us for a couple of iterations on site. And as we do this, we're going to figure out how he can become the voice of the test team to the customer here in the U.S., it happened to be. And so they decided that there would be such a risk if they started from the beginning with just doing handovers to testing. But they needed to learn how to work together and have somebody on site for a while where more of the people were co-located and then build out how they were going to collaborate and have ways to tune their collaboration practices on a regular basis.
Mm.
So, you know, products get built by teams that are in trust and can trust each other. So another recommendation I would have, and it seems like, oh, we can't do that because it's going to cost too much, but it pays back in spades, is to pull the team together and change locations where you do that, but pull the team together at the beginning to do visioning and chartering and that high-level product roadmap.
Yep.
That pays for itself very, very quickly.
Yeah, that's been really useful because it's not just you're either co-located or you're all completely separate, but actually how can you make it closer to that co-located even if some of you need to be separate? So
right.
bringing people together and having feature teams and bringing leads over, making sure that people really know how they work together. Yeah, really useful stuff.
Yeah.
I've got some questions which maybe I should have asked a little bit earlier because maybe they're a little bit more fundamental. But somebody's asked, what role does an analyst have in Scrum?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this is a very good question, a very common question, a conundrum for Agile teams, and a lot of analysts wondering, gee, where do I fit? Where do I fit? Because I don't see that role. If you back up and think about Scrum, Scrum is essentially an agile project management framework. It's not a methodology. It's one of the umbrella agile approaches. And in Scrum, there's three roles, three meetings, and three artifacts. The roles are the Scrum Master, the product owner, and the team member. The meetings are the sprint planning meeting, the demonstration, and the retrospective. And the artifacts are the backlog, the product backlog, I should say, the sprint backlog, and the burn down chart. So if we go back to the roles, you have Scrum Master, product owner, team member. The role of the business analyst isn't called out per se. But then again, with the team member, and I like to call them the delivery team, it's not calling out a tester. It's not calling out a lead architect or developer or a database administrator or data administrator or documentation analyst. It's just a delivery team member. Now, here's the thing, is that the skills of the of a business analyst could be used for any of those roles. Let's take the Scrum Master. I work with a team that builds commercial software, and one of their business analysts, and I was coaching her as well as doing some agile jumpstart work and building their backlog and iteration planning, she ended up being the Scrum Master because she had really good collaboration skills. She could lead the team enough and stay neutral enough for the planning exercises. So her analysis skills and her collaboration skills and her desire to play that role of the facilitative leader, leader, not the director, really suited her well, and it was great. She was one of the best, quote, Scrum Masters. I personally don't like that master part of the term because you're really more of a facilitator than anything else in that role. But the most common thing is that an analyst will either be part of the delivery team or be the product owner. Now, there's a really important distinction here. The product owner, and maybe that's not the best term either, but that's the customer. That's the product champion. The product owner has this huge responsibility of deciding what are we going to build when. So it's about deciding, picking the items in the product backlog, and the backlog is basically the baseline of requirements, and making the final decision in collaboration with the team, with input from the team, but saying, you know what, this is the most valuable thing for us to do next. And it requires understanding the business domain and also the strategy. So will a business analyst be given, delegated, decision-making authority from iteration to iteration? This is a black or white question. If they are given a decision to say, we're going to build this requirement or story or whatever you use for your backlog items, this is what we're going to do in the next iteration, making those decisions and answering questions about doneness, acceptance criteria, then perhaps we don't call that person a business analyst. They are the product owner. Now, what often happens is product owners are so busy and they have to keep their eye on the marketplace, whether they're external or their products are being built for external or internal use, and the strategy, that a business analyst might end up having authority to be a tactical product owner that works in sync with a strategic outward-facing product owner. And that's a really clever and smart role, if you will, if you want to call it a role. Now, as a delivery team member, though, here's the thing. Business analysis doesn't go away. The formal role may not be called out, but the skills are absolutely necessary. Analysis does not go away because you're using agile practices. And not all team members have those analysis skills. The requirements work. We often get involved with teams that have been doing Agile sometimes for several years and have the practices from a project management point of view, but they're still having difficulty dealing with prioritizing their backlog, slicing stories so that they stories being the small chunks of requirements that we deliver in sets in each iteration. They carry over from iteration for iteration. Or the customer says at the demonstration, that's not really what I want. Mm-hmm. We're still having those problems which are related to requirements and analysis, and this is where the skills of the classic, you know, if we use the role name, the business analyst is needed. Analysis is still needed.
Okay. So another question. How is the increasing prominence of agile development approaches affecting the area where most BAs spend most of their time gathering and documenting user requirements? Seems to be related to what you just said.
Okay. So, yes. Well, first I would request that we don't use the term gathering, because requirements aren't just sitting around waiting to be picked up. We like to use the term elicitation. And in the Software Requirements Memory Jogger, the second book I wrote, we talked about in the book requirements development and management. And requirements development includes elicitation, analysis, specification, and validation. All of those practices still must be done. The timing of them is what changes. So if we're spending a lot of time doing elicitation and documentation in general, I'm not sure that's where the value is. I think that, and this is a good thing for the practice and art and science of business analysis, the days of being note takers and recorders for business analysis, those days really need to end, whether you're doing agile or not. I remember working not too long ago with an agile team, and we were about to do some work on building in our backlog and pruning the backlog for figuring out our next iteration. And the team members said, turn to the person who was the business analyst up to there, and remember they're transforming themselves into agile practices, and said, okay, well, so let's call her Betty. Betty, the BA, Betty's going to do the recording, right? And so and she kind of glared at me because we had had this discussion offline about, you know, all they think of me is a glorified note taker. So I gently asked the project lead or scrum master, if we use scrum vernacular, would it be possible for you to take notes in this session? We can just rotate them. rotate taking the notes. And she did, and, you know, I helped her so that it was projected on the wall. But then what I did quite quickly after there, after that, was what I call a role pointer exercise. And people draw on a poster with a big giant arrow, aspects of where they, what their skill needs are, what they need from other people, what they do for other people, and have them go up and look at each other. And they had some really deep discussion about what they wanted to do as well as what their skill capabilities were. And that issue about the note-taking was then very explicitly discussed with the team. So we got to get away from that. We really do have to get away from that. Elicitation really is very key for business analysis, whether you're doing agile or not. So what happens, though, in agile is that elicitation is done more frequently and continually. It's not like this one-shot deal. And then in terms of documentation, wow, that really does also need to change in agile. What we need to do is lighten and tighten is a good way to think of it. Take a consumer's view. Who is going to use all this documentation, and how are they going to use it? Because documentation, like anything else that we create, any work that we produce, should be valuable. It should be useful. And so we want to rethink the form and format of the documentation and think of the value of the documentation. I think of that documentation as work in three levels: work in progress, handover, and product. And they are increasing in value. Work in progress, to do a lot of documentation about work in progress documentation, work in progress, say, analysis for delivering some software or some solution, it's going to be thrown away later. It's only for the team's use. Do we really need to spend much time on that? Can't we just use a whiteboard or, you know, a flip chart paper? Now, when we go to handover, that's a different story. You were kind of bringing up the point, right, of an offshore team.
Of course.
Have to do some handover. Well, that's a little bit more important and valuable, but maybe we don't have to fill out all parts of this template. So one of the things that we can do is look at documentation as another asset of value and test what is the leanest possible documentation that's going to be useful for those people we have to hand it over to.
Yeah.
And do the same, right? We want to do the same thing with product documentation, which is, you know, manuals, user guides, maintenance guides, help desk support, a marketing collateral. That stuff has more value, but are we building the right thing for the consumer? I was with a team that the product manager, who is the product owner, we were doing some planning around what we were going to deliver in the next iteration. And somebody asked the question for a story. Well, what about, this is for commercial usage, what about documentation, the user manual? Should that be part of the acceptance criteria for delivering this user story? And so the product owner turned to the user experience person and said, well, you know, for our current product, how much of, what's the research tell us? How much of the online documentation are our customers actually using? And the user experience person, who had some good research data, thank goodness, behind her, said, well, actually, they only use less than 10%. So the product owner, I could have kissed her. She said, well, then I don't want to spend any time or money doing user manual as we go here. Let's do some research and figure out what they really need.
Yep.
And so we wrote a story for the backlog to do some research on how and what documentation the customer, the consumer really needs. So, you know, that was really very powerful. Why do we document? Not just because we have a checklist that says do this document or a template, right?
Yeah.
So it should be looked at as a value. And of course, you know, the last point I would make here is that from a regulatory point of view, you also need to consider what, for risk mitigation purposes, what do we need to deliver, what's the minimum possible stuff we need to deliver. And what I found working with organizations that have regulatory compliance issues is that they become quite surprised on how much they can kill in their standard documentation.
Just tends to grow and grow and grow, doesn't it? People add, oh, we need to add that, and we need to add this. So I think what you're saying makes such a lot of sense for both Agile and people who, you know, at the moment don't consider themselves to be working in an Agile way.
Those things make great sense. Yeah. Penny, I think that's a really good point, that you don't have to be formally doing Agile to be using many of these common sense practical practices.
Ellen, our time is short, but there's a last question which says, what's your opinion about the future movements of Agile business analysis practice? So maybe just a few words about where you think we're going.
Okay, well, one thing is that I think we're going to see more and more organizations adapting Agile practices, that it certainly, the research shows that it's moving more in the mainstream, and organizations that haven't been doing it are trying it out, hopefully not for reasons of hype, but for reasons of business value.
Yep.
One of the things I think in terms of impacting Agile business analysis practice that is going to happen is, and I'm really grateful for this because it's the real intent, Agile is going to move upstream, up the value stream. So it's going to move out of just software development team, where, you know, the more modern movement of Agile with the Agile Manifesto from a bunch of what's perceived software development geeks, it's going to move from the software team upstream, where product managers, business managers, and executives are going to start to understand the value of some of these practices and the thinking processes that Agile gives us. So I think there's going to be an increasing need for the tools and techniques that business analysis lends to smart decision making, so we deliver the right solutions that may or may not involve technology. You know, personally, over 12 years ago, I was very deeply involved in working in the business rules community and building meta models and so forth. And that really was very important for my development in helping me get a deep understanding about how decision making and sound thinking about goals and objectives and reasoning really is very separate from business solutions. You know, the recent conference in the U.S., the title is Building Business Capability, which I think is a great title. Technology is really enablement. So, you know, while the Agile movement might be the latest incarnation of a semi-silver bullet that's arising from the software development community, the values and principles make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And another trend that we're seeing more and more of is that many agilists are looking and adapting practices from lean and lean thinking, which is looking at the whole value stream, if you will. And so what this means in terms of IIBA, BA-BOC is we're really talking about what's called in the BA-BOC enterprise analysis. And so this is a huge challenge and a fabulous opportunity for those that are in called or call themselves business analysts to really ratchet up their game, cut to the core, play a leadership role in a culture of collaboration, challenging business thinking, driving ambiguity out, ensuring strategic alignment, thinking like testers at a management level, thinking like product managers at a business level. So I think it's very powerful and very positive.
And Ellen, what you just said fits in so well with what the other speakers are saying as well, that things are moving up front, moving into the value that we're going to provide, moving into the business and upstream on projects right up at the beginning, where things are very ambiguous. Fantastic. We could go on for hours, I'm sure, but unfortunately, we're really coming up to the end of our time that we have. So, Ellen, I'd like to say a huge thank you to you for taking part in this virtual summit. I'm sure everyone listening in today and those replaying later will find your content really, really useful. You've given us so much to think about and certainly some things that we can start working on straight away. I'm quite surprised to find maybe, although I've never worked on a Scrum project, maybe at heart I'm an agile person. It certainly aligns with so many of the values in the way I work. So that's been great. Thank you from me and from everybody else. Now, before you go, I know you've got some really good resources for business analysts. So many articles, books, courses, online courses, consultancy and so on. Where can people find out more about this?
Yes, great. Thank you for asking. Thank you for having me. If you go to our website, ebgconsulting.com, and there's a link on your BA Summit site too, we have chock full of information. In particular, I think I would point out that if you sign up for our newsletter, that would be great. We don't spam you, maybe do 8 times a year, and we provide news and links of interest. We also have, if you go to the newsletter page, there's an archive with lots and lots of articles, short articles. We also have a blog on the bottom right. You can click on the blog, and there's some really interesting, diverse things to read about in our blog, and we have lots of resources and publications. The publication pages has information on requirements, on Agile, on workshops, and there's also specific to Agile. If you go to our website and then type in /lowercaseagile.pdf, all lowercase,
okay,
we put together a PDF that's about 6 pages with really a whole set of resources that people have found useful. I wanted to let people know, as far as the software requirement, memory jogger. If you, I've got my publisher to provide a really good discount to IIBA members. So if you go to the picture of the jogger book on the right side, click on that, and then there's a link to the publisher, which is called QPC. You can put on a coupon code of IIBA. That's all you have to put in, and you'll get a discount that actually gets you the jogger a little bit cheaper even than Amazon.
Fantastic.
So those are some of the things, and one last thing I'd mention is our foundation, self-paced e-learning. We offer a discount for newsletter subscribers. If you're not a subscriber, don't want to, just email me and I'll get you that discount code as well.
Wow.
We also have, and one other thing I wanted, for those studying for the BOC, I wanted to mention is that under resources, we put together, and I want to credit Mary Gorman because she did the lion's share of all this work, cross-reference resources for tasks and techniques, and their cross-reference to the jogger as well. And we have some chapters that have been using it as part of their study guide. And it's free, and it's just, you know, something that you might find really useful for studying for either your CBAP or the CCBA exam.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ellen. Right. Thank you, too, for everyone who's listened right through to the very end. In case you have to miss any of the sessions or if you'd like to listen again another time, you can upgrade to gain permanent access to all of the sessions in the summit. To do so, go to www.basummit.com/upgrade for more details. Until next time, all the best. Bye.